Chapter 16. The files were biographical. There were 12 in total. 11 were bundles of raw data, like newspaper cuttings and interviews and depositions and other first-generation paperwork. The 12th was a comprehensive summary of the first 11. It was as thick as a medieval Bible, and it read like a book. It narrated the whole story of Brooke Armstrong's life, and every substantive fact had a number following it in parentheses. The number indicated on a scale of 1 to 10 how solidly the fact had been authenticated. Most of the numbers were tens. The story started on page 1 with his parents. His mother had grown up in Oregon, moved to Washington State for college, returned to Oregon to start work as a pharmacist. Her own parents and siblings were sketched in, and the whole of her education was listed from kindergarten to postgraduate school. Her early employers were listed in sequence, and the startup of her own pharmacy business had 3 pages all to itself. She still owned it and still took income from it, but she was now retired and sick with something that was feared to be terminal. His father's education was listed. His military service had a start date and a medical discharge date, but there were no details beyond that. He was an Oregon native who married a pharmacist on his return to civilian life. They moved to an isolated village in the southwest corner of the state, and he used family money to buy himself a lumber business. The newlyweds had a daughter soon afterward, and Brooke Armstrong himself was born 2 years later. The family business prospered and grew to a decent size. Its progress and development had several pages all to itself. It provided a pleasant, provincial lifestyle. The sister's biography was a half-inch thick itself, so Reacher skipped over it and started in on Brooke's education. It began like everybody else's in kindergarten. There were endless details, too many to pay close attention to, so he leafed ahead and skimmed. Armstrong went all the way through the local school system. He was good at sports. He got excellent grades. The father had a stroke and died just after Armstrong left home for college. The lumber business was sold. The pharmacy continued to prosper. Armstrong himself spent 7 years in 2 different universities, first Cornell in upstate New York, and then Stanford in California. He had long hair, but no proven drug use. He met a Bismarck girl at Stanford. They were both political science postgraduates. They got married. They made their home in North Dakota, and he started his political career with a campaign for a seat in the state legislature.
"I need to get home," Swain said. "It's Thanksgiving, and I've got kids, and my wife is going to kill me."
Reacher looked ahead at the rest of the file. Armstrong was just starting in on his first minor election, and there were 6 more inches of paperwork to go. He fanned through it with his thumb.
"Nothing here to worry us?" "Nothing anywhere."
"Does this level of detail continue throughout?"
"It gets worse."
"Am I going to find anything if I read all night?"
"No."
"Was all of it used in this summer's campaign?" Swain nodded.
"Sure. It's a great bio. That's why he was picked in the first place. Actually, we got a lot of the detail from the campaign."
"And you're sure nobody in particular was upset by the campaign?"
"I'm sure."
"So where exactly does your feeling come from?
Who hates Armstrong that bad, and why?"
"I don't know exactly. It's just a feeling." Reacher nodded.
"Okay. Go home."
Swain picked up his coat and left in a hurry, and Reacher sampled his way through the remaining years. Nagley leafed through the endless source material. They both gave it up after an hour.
"Conclusions?" Nagley asked.
"Swain has got a very boring job," Reacher said.
She smiled.
"Agreed."
"But something kind of jumps out at me. Something that's not here rather than something that is here. Campaigns are cynical, right? These people will use any old thing that puts them in a good light. So, for instance, we've got his mother. We've got endless detail about her college degrees and her pharmacy thing. Why?"
"To appeal to independent women and small business people."
"Okay. And then we've got stuff about her getting sick. Why?"
"So Armstrong looks like a caring son, very dutiful and full of family values. It humanizes him, and it authenticates his issues about health care."
"And we've got plenty of stuff about his dad's lumber company."
"For the business lobby again. And it touches on environmental concerns. You know, trees and logging and all that kind of thing. Armstrong can say he's got practical knowledge. He's walked the walk, at one remove."
"Exactly. Whatever the issue, whatever the constituency, they find a bone to throw."
"So?"
They took a pass on military service. And usually they love all that stuff in a campaign. Normally, if your dad was in the army, you'd shout it from the rooftops to wrap up another whole bunch of issues. But there's no detail at all. He joined, he got discharged. That's all we know. See what I mean? We're drowning in detail everywhere else, but not there. It stands out.
The father died ages ago.
Doesn't matter. They'd have been all over it if there was something to be gained. And what was the medical discharge for? If it had been a wound, they'd have made something out of it for sure. Even a training accident. The guy would have been a big hero. And you know what? I don't like to see unexplained medical discharges. You know how it was. It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
I guess it does.
But it can't be connected. It happened before Armstrong was even born. Then the guy died nearly 30 years ago. And you said it yourself, this all was triggered by something Armstrong did in the campaign.
Reacher nodded. But I'd still like to know more about it. We could ask Armstrong direct, I guess.
Don't need to, Nagley said. I can find out if you really need me to. I can make some calls. We've got plenty of contacts. People who figure on getting a job with us when they quit are generally interested in making a good impression beforehand.
Reacher yawned.
Okay, do it. First thing tomorrow.
I'll do it tonight. The military is still 24/7. Hasn't changed any since we quit.
You should sleep. It can wait.
I never sleep anymore.
Reacher yawned again.
Well, I'm going to.
Bad day,
Nagley said. Reacher nodded. As bad as they get.
So make the calls if you want to, but don't wake me up to tell me about them. Tell me about them tomorrow.
The night duty officer fixed them a ride back to the Georgetown Motel, and Reacher went straight to his room. It was quiet and still and empty. It had been cleaned and tidied. The bed was made. Joe's box had gone. He sat in the chair for a moment and wondered if Stuyvesant had thought to cancel Froelich's booking. Then the nighttime silence pressed in on him, and he was overcome by a sense of something not there. A sense of absence. Things that should be there and weren't.
What, exactly?
Froelich, of course. He had an ache for her. She should be there, and she wasn't. She had been there the last time he was in the room, early that morning.
Today's the day we win or lose, she had said.
Losing is not an option, he had replied.
Something not there.
Maybe Joe himself. Maybe lots of things. There were lots of things missing from his life. Things not done, things not said.
What exactly?
Maybe it was just Armstrong's father's service career on his mind.
But maybe it was more than that. Was something else missing?
He closed his eyes and chased it hard, but all he saw was the pink spray of Froelich's blood arcing backward into the sunlight. So he opened his eyes again and stripped off his clothes and showered for the third time that day. He found himself staring down at the tray like he was still expecting to see it run red, but it stayed clear and white. The bed was cold and hard, and the new sheets were stiff with starch. He slipped in alone and stared at the ceiling for an hour and thought hard. Then he switched off abruptly and made himself sleep. He dreamed of his brother strolling hand in hand with Froelich all the way around the tidal basin in summer. The light was soft and golden, and the blood streaming from her neck hung in the still warm air like a shimmering red ribbon 5 feet above the ground. It hung there undisturbed by the passing crowds, and it made a full mile-wide circle when she and Joe arrived back where they had started. Then she changed into Swain, and Joe changed into the Bismarck cop. The cop's coat flapped open as he walked, and Swain said, "I think we miscounted," to everybody he met. Then Swain changed into Armstrong. Armstrong smiled his brilliant politician's smile and said, "I'm so sorry." And the cop turned and threaded a long gun out from under his flapping coat and slowly racked the bolt and shot Armstrong in the head. There was no sound because the gun was silenced. No sound, even as Armstrong hit the water and floated away. There was an alarm call from the desk at 6 o'clock, and a minute later there was a knock at the door. Reacher rolled out of bed and wrapped the towel around his waist and checked the spy hole. It was Nagley, with coffee for him. She was all dressed and ready to go. He let her in and sat on the bed and started the coffee, and she paced the narrow alley that led to the window. She was wired.
looked like she'd been drinking coffee all night.
"Okay. Armstrong's father?"
she said, like she was asking the question for him.
"He was drafted right at the end of Korea. Never saw active service, but he went through officer training and came out a second lieutenant and was assigned to an infantry company. They were stationed in Alabama, some place that's long gone. They were ordered to achieve battle readiness for a fight everybody knew was already over. And you know how that stuff went, right?"
Reacher nodded sleepily, sipped his coffee.
"Some idiot captain running endless competitions," he said. "Points for this, points for that, deductions all over the place. At the end of the month, Company B gets to keep a flag in its barracks for kicking Company A's ass."
"And Armstrong Sr. usually won," Nagley said. "He ran a tight unit, but he had a temper problem. It was unpredictable. If somebody screwed up and lost points, he could fly into a rage. Happened a couple of times. Not just the usual officer bullshit. It's described in the records as serious, uncontrolled temper tantrums. He went way too far, like he couldn't stop himself."
"And?"
"They let him get away with it twice. It wasn't constant, it was purely episodic. But the third time there was some real serious physical abuse, and they kicked him out for it. And they covered it up, basically. They gave him a psychological discharge, wrote it up as generic battle stress, even though he'd never been a combat officer."
Reacher made a face. "He must have had friends. And so must you to get that deep into the records."
"I've been on the phone all night. Stuyvesant's going to have a coronary when he sees the motel bill."
"How many individual victims?"
"My first thought, but we can forget them. There were three, one for each incident. One was KIA in Vietnam, one died 10 years ago in Palm Springs, and the third is more than 70 years old, lives in Florida."
"Dry hole," Reacher said.
"But it explains why they left it out of the campaign."
Reacher nodded, sipped his coffee. "Any chance Armstrong himself inherited the temper? Froelich said she'd seen him angry."
"That was my second thought," Nagley said. "It's conceivable. There was something there below the surface when he was insisting on going to her surface, wasn't there? But I assume the broader picture would have come out already, long ago. The guy's been running for office at one level or another his whole life, and this all started with the campaign this summer. We already agreed on that."
Reacher nodded vaguely. "The campaign," he repeated. He sat still with the coffee cup in his hand, stared straight ahead at the wall, one full minute, then two.
"What?"
Nagley asked. He didn't reply, just got up and walked to the window, pulled back the shades and looked out at slices and slivers of D.C. under the gray dawn sky.
"What did Armstrong do in the campaign?" he asked. "Lots of things."
"How many representatives does New Mexico have?"
"I don't know," Nagley said.
"I think it's three. Can you name them?"
"No."
"Would you recognize any of them on the street?"
"No."
"Oklahoma?"
"Don't know. Five?"
"Six, I think. Can you name them?"
"One of them is an asshole, I know that. Can't remember his name."
"Senators from Tennessee?"
"What's your point?"
Reacher stared out of the window. "We've got beltway disease," he said. "We're all caught up in it. We're not looking at this thing like real people. To almost everybody else out there in the country, all these politicians are absolute nobodies. You said it yourself. You said you're interested in politics, but you couldn't name all 100 senators. And most people are 1,000 times less interested than you. Most people wouldn't recognize another state's junior senator if he ran up and bit them in the ass. Or she, as Froelich would have said." She actually admitted nobody had ever heard of Armstrong before.
"So?"
"So Armstrong did one absolutely basic, fundamental, elemental thing in the campaign. He put himself in the public eye, nationally. For the very first time in his life, ordinary people outside of his home state and outside of his circle of friends saw his face, heard his name, for the first time ever. I think this all could be as basic as that."
"In what way?"
"Suppose his face came back at somebody from way in the past, completely out of the blue, like a sudden shock."
"Like who?"
Like you're some guy somewhere, and long ago some young man lost his temper and smacked you around. Some situation like that. Maybe in a bar, maybe over a girl. Maybe he humiliated you by doing so. You never see the guy again, but the incident festers in your mind. Years pass, and suddenly
There's the guy, all over the papers and the TV. He's a politician running for vice president. You never heard of him in the years before because you don't watch C-SPAN or CNN. But now, there he is, everywhere, in your face. So what do you do? If you're politically aware, you might call the opposing campaign and dish the dirt. But you're not politically aware, because this is the first time you've ever seen him since the fight in the bar a lifetime ago. So what do you do? The sight of him brings it all back. It's been festering.